From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. There are many things that can excite a community when it's announced they're coming to town. A new restaurant, a new supermarket, or a new coffee shop, just to name a few. What most likely won't make the list of exciting attractions is a new immigration and customs enforcement facility. Yet, that is what the citizens of Roseburg are pondering right now. Today on the show, we talk with a reporter at the Roseburg News Review about an initial filing of interest for ICE to locate in that town. Then, in a decidedly different story about something new coming to a community, we talk with Kyra Buckley of OPB about how the WNBA's newest team, the Portland Fire, are finally ready to begin their inaugural season. That's next on Oregon on the Record. Many listeners remember the anger and public discord over the proposed location of an ICE facility in Newport. Well, it seems like that same sentiment is happening in Roseburg, as reporting has determined the agency is taking the first steps towards a possible facility there. We talk now with the reporter who broke that story. Patrick Moore, reporter with the News Review. Patrick, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I read your article about the possibility, preliminary planning perhaps, for an ICE facility coming to Roseburg. Before I ask you about the article, my first question for you is, how did you even find out about it? As I understand it, ICE doesn't necessarily shout from the rooftops when it wants to locate a facility in a community.
Sure. Yeah, and I believe the information was relatively public if one knows where to look for it.
Okay.
I received a couple tips that morning, Monday morning. What they call an RFI, request for information, had gone out the previous Friday, March the 20th, and the people who tipped me off to it had been tipped off to it themselves and didn't care to reveal their sources, which is fine because I was able to, you know, confirm it myself. And just by going to the right website and looking at what's called the RFI, which, like I said, is the request for information.
Maybe before I get too far ahead of myself, explain what this process was. As I read your article, it's sort of less than an RFP, acronym people
yeah.
might be familiar with, request for proposal. Talk about what this sort of says.
No, I mean, I'm glad you brought up that term and you're aware of it too. The people from their mission support division, I think it's called the Office for Acquisition Management, they were pretty quick and professional in getting back to me and clarifying that, yes, an RFI is essentially one or two steps below an RFP. So it's an initial offering, if you will.
Sure.
Yeah, are any of our licensed vendors in possession of facilities or infrastructure that would fit this, you know, what's called the SOW, the statement of work? So it was pretty broad, both broad and vague, actually, at the same time, essentially looking for workstations with surrounded by or in addition to some private offices and nothing more than Wi-Fi and a photocopier.
Huh. Interesting. So it could be pretty small or it could be pretty large. I guess what I'm asking is, can you tell us anything from the documents you've seen what it could be if it ever sort of got off the ground?
No, but that is what the acquisitions office confirmed for me is they won't even know what the total infrastructure requirements will be until and unless it reaches that RFP level.
Okay. Okay.
So they put out the same language to all 50 states.
Okay. Okay. I guess it would be also hard to determine where, if it were to be green lit, it's really hard to determine where in Roseburg it could be located. It really could be kind of anywhere, couldn't it?
That is exactly what I asked them as well. Are they looking for something, you know, downtown or, you know, across town, you know, in the more commercial areas? Downtown, you know, being a county seat is where a lot of the governmental infrastructure is. They said not even that was within their statement of work or their project parameters at that point in time until they got the RFIs and then presumably narrow it down from that point.
Okay. You were able to talk to some local opposition leaders with regard to ICE. Tell our audience what they told you.
Yeah, and actually more than I probably was able to fit and quote, actually, into a single article, which, you know, obviously wanted to turn around that same night. It was really a coincidence, as far as I know, that a city council meeting, Roseburg City Council meeting, was occurring that following Monday, the 23rd, just, you know, the weekend after, excuse me, just a couple days after the statement of work had gone public. But somebody got organized pretty quickly because the council chambers filled up. Obviously, the city council meeting may not be the proper venue for opposition in terms of, you know, their authority to do anything about it. But the answers I got when I asked that question was that they were essentially following the what they called the Newport playbook, getting the publicity out there as quickly and as early as possible. That was their statements for their reason for choosing that venue. It was available and public and is recorded. As far as the reasons for the opposition, you know, unfortunately, the things most poignantly in the public narrative right now are the most tragic incidents, the ones that get the national and international coverage. Sure. So, there was some discussion, you know, both on and off the record about the extreme examples of, you know, arrests going wrong the tactics, the searches, things of that nature, you know, encroachment upon workplaces, you know, other areas of privacy. That's what most people who had concerns stated to me as their own concerns.
Okay. Let me quickly reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to Patrick Moore. He's a reporter with the News Review. You know, it's interesting you brought up Newport. And obviously, you know, what happened in that community, I don't know. I could imagine that the people you talk to in Roseburg might look at that and say, follow that playbook because it seems to have worked and also seemed to attract some pretty heavyweight support, U.S. senators, congresspeople. Is that kind of the hope here, is to maybe, you know, full court press in Roseburg before this can even get maybe to the RFP a step?
Correct. Yeah. Drawing as much attention and publicity and public comment as possible, and recognizing that there are differences between, you know, a town on the north coast, more central coast, and versus a town on the southern end of the freeway.
Let's say it progresses down the road to becoming something where it's a feasible project. Would the city council even have authority over it, or what do they feel like their role might be with regard to something like this?
That's a great question. I spoke to, and I believe I reported on some of her comments, a former city manager who had of another Oregon town, who'd also worked in municipal government extensively in California. And one of the things that she said was that the you know, the symbolism of a council voting on and drafting a joint letter can be powerful. That was one of her I don't want to say predictions, but suggestions. Now, as to the Roseburg City Council, you know, I don't have a prediction as to whether they would be interested in something like that. As you've probably experienced yourselves, city councils are very interesting to watch because, you know, they're nonpartisan positions. Their campaigns are nonpartisan. Just about the time you think that I think I have them somewhat figured out, you know, I'll see two relatively progressive members or two relatively conservative members end up on the opposite sides of a vote or argue about an issue. So I don't know where they'd come out. It's a 9-person council, so it's not small. A lot of different personalities.
Yeah. My last question for you is this. Having gone to the council meeting, and I know you talked to some folks, but could you read the room and I mean, I don't know, put a percentage on the number of people who were there to oppose it? Were there some people who were there to support it? Kind of give us a gauge of where you think public sentiment for whatever ICE may do in Roseburg is.
Sure. And, you know, my estimate based on, people I recognized from other venues, a few I personally had spoken to on other topics, and the amount of applause in the room combined with the public comment, it was 100% opposed. That's okay. Just who showed up.
Okay.
For that particular meeting, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see where this goes, and I'm sure we'll go to you again to see what might happen with regard to the potential for some type of ICE facility in Roseburg or not. Patrick Moore is a reporter at the News Review. Patrick, really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
No, thanks for having us.
Let's now get an update on one of the most anticipated occurrences in Oregon, the first season for the WNBA's Portland Fire. Kyra Buckley, business reporter for OPB. Kyra, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, gosh, I'm thinking of that expression, building the airplane while it's in flight. And we're talking about the fire. I think it's an apt description. Give folks kind of the level set on where the team is, especially now because the agreement between the owners and the players has been settled. We're ready to play, but they need one thing, don't they? A team.
Yeah. Yes, correct. They need players, essentially. So basically, the Fire have just a few weeks to accomplish what most expansion teams get about 5 or 6 months to do.
Wow.
And that's put together a roster of players to then show up at training camp in late April, practice with the team. The team will still make changes up until tip off and even into the season, as many W fans know, but the core roster is normally set by the end of training camp and before that first game, which for the Fire is May 9th. So, Michael, as you mentioned, the labor negotiations between the WNBA and the Players Union held up that process for Portland and the other expansion team, Toronto. So it's crunch time if the Portland Fire want to have a roster of 12 players ready to go on May 9th.
So how do they do that? How do they build a roster?
So it starts with an expansion draft, and the WNBA just announced that the expansion draft is going to take place on April 3rd. And that's the process where new teams essentially get to pick players that are already in the league. I'll explain that process a little bit more in depth in a minute,
okay.
But to then fill it out. So you do the expansion draft, and then after that, there's a process called free agency, and that's when all teams, including the expansion teams, trade with each other. They make deals. Those are super complex. They normally happen behind closed doors. But that's when you hear about things like, oh, this team traded such and such player for two other players and a draft pick in 4 years. So that process is about to happen again, truncated. It'll just be a few weeks, and I expect it to be crazy. So the Portland Fire could get more players that way. And then, of course, there is the college draft, and that is happening, I believe, April 19th is the date for that. And that is when all teams get to pick either, depending on their lottery, where they are in the draft, get to pick from incoming players from college or international players. So those are generally the three ways that the Fire get to get players. And again, you normally have 5 or 6 months to do this. They're doing it in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, yeah, that's just breakneck speed. And I'm wondering, too, as I understand it, neither the Toronto team or the Portland team, they can't get the first pick in the college draft. Is that correct?
That's a great question. I don't believe so, because normally the first pick in the draft goes to one of the four teams that didn't make the playoffs the previous year. And so they do a lottery, and then those are the teams that tend to get to pick the first few draft picks. Portland and Toronto, my understanding is that they are 6th and 7th in the first round.
Okay.
And it just depends on a whole host of things, which one of them gets to pick sixth and which seventh.
So other other WNBA teams, they can protect a certain number of players from going into the expansion draft. So they would keep, you know, at least theoretically, their best players, and then open their roster up to other players. And so then the Toronto team or the Portland team could then pick from that group. Is that basically it?
Correct. My understanding is that teams can protect one or more players, and then Toronto and Portland can only pick one player from each existing team. And again, this is kind of a crazy time because normally there's rules around who's a core player, who's already on contract. But 80% of the WNBA are free agents right now. Okay. And so Toronto and Portland are going to have to make some pretty challenging decisions just because they are going to have so many great players that they may be able to pick from. But they will be limited when they do that expansion draft on April 3rd. They will be limited to just picking one player from each team. And yes, those teams can protect players. So one would think that, I'm just going to say, Las Vegas is probably going to want to protect Asia Wilson, reigning MVP. Yeah. I'm just predicting here.
I think the Liberty are going to hold on to Sabrina as well. So
I'm always willing to be surprised, and I am forever an optimist. But Sabrina has expressed that she is quite happy in New York.
I get it. Let me reintroduce you to the audience, talking with business reporter Kyra Buckley up at OPB. So let's talk about what the Fire have. They have a GM, they have a coaching staff in place, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And so that's the brain trust that's going to be building this roster. Let's talk also about this collective bargaining agreement that was negotiated. And as I understand it, what's great about it, if you're pro player, is it does free up more money to pay players. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, this is really a historic deal. They keep saying that, but it's true, because it's going to create the first million plus earner among WNBA players. It's also going to vastly increase starting salaries. And Michael, I really think that the most important point that the players are going to keep highlighting is that when it comes to revenue sharing, so how the league is literally doling out the increasing revenue it's making back to its players, the WNBA, the players were able to secure an equation that looks more similar to the NBA, where they are going to get a percentage of gross revenue. It's around 20% is what is being reported right now. That's different from what the league wanted. They had suggested sharing net revenue, which is revenue minus expenses. And the players really held the line on that and said, we want part of gross revenue, like players in other professional, specifically professional male leagues. That's the equation that they often get. So that is why not only are players going to get paid more than, you know, American women have been paid before in professional sports, but also on top of that, they really secured this revenue sharing model that's going to grow over the life of the CBA. And it just kind of shows a little bit more equity towards what their male counterparts are making.
Okay. And certainly we have talked about this before, and we've seen it, is that this is a growth sport. This is becoming extremely popular. I'm wondering if is part of the agreement or just part of the business of the WNBA right now, have they secured or are they attempting to secure a more robust, you know, TV deal? And specifically, how can folks in Oregon, outside of Portland, watch the games?
Oh, this is my favorite question. yes and yes. So the WNBA has really, as you mentioned, it has exploded in popularity. And that is mostly because more people are able to watch it. It is easier to watch games on TV. And that has changed dramatically over the last 5 years. So Yes, the players are going to see the, well, I'll start here. The league will see revenue go up, and that's partially because in the last 2 years, they've negotiated better TV deals. That's also why the league was confident that they could hold up their end of the bargain for the CBA, is because they have seen their investment and the growth in revenue to be able to say, okay, we know more eyeballs are on the sport. We're getting better TV deals, and that's going to continue to keep growing and growing. So if you do not live in Portland and you want to watch the Portland Fire, there's a couple of options. CBS Sports is actually going to air more WNBA games this season than they ever have before. So check that schedule. If you have cable, ESPN also carries more of the sport than ever. You can also sign up for the WNBA League Pass. And I swear they do not pay me to say this, but I think it is a great deal in sports because it's a one-time payment for the whole season. And you don't always get to watch games in live time, but you get access to every game. And so if you are a Fire fan, you will be guaranteed that you'll get to see all of those games. And if you want to check out other teams too, you'll have access to that. That is the most that I know. Also, find a bar, find a sports bar, tell them to put women's sports on TV, and they have more access to it before. And we know that because of course, the sports bra here in Portland and the work that they've done to help really make it easier for sports bars to have access. So you will find it on a TV. That is my message. If you want to watch the Portland Fire, it is out there. And of course, we would love to see people up here in Portland live for games as well.
She's Kyra Buckley, covers business and covers the WNBA for OPB. Kyra, always appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Monday on the show, they zip around at speeds that can sometimes make walkers and joggers tremble with fear. They're e-bikes, and they're all the rage. We'll talk with the City of Eugene staffers about what's legal and illegal about these electric vehicles and how the city is trying to reduce dangerous interactions between two-wheeled and two-legged travelers. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.